Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Extra time.
Hello and welcome back to the Extra Time podcast. It's me, Patrick Van Straten, your host. And today I'm joined by Joe Tomlinson. Hello, Joe. How are you?
Yes, back in the podcast game. I'm excited to be here, mate. I had a very nice weekend. I have my parents down.
Oh, so nice.
I took them to Richmond Park, saw a few deer. And took them out for a nice meal in the evening. So I'm feeling quite happy, quite positive. The sun's out in London. How are you feeling today?
I don't feel too bad, actually, given that it's a Monday. Yeah, the sun is helping me out. You were in my neck of the woods, man. Richmond Park's like 10 minutes from my house.
Beautiful place, mate. I've never been there before. And you can actually get so close to the deers.
Yeah, the deer are like, they genuinely block the road half the time, which I kind of like about them. I've seen one almost knock a cyclist off his bike, which I did laugh at quite a lot as well. So,
what do you think the penalty would be if, like, not that I'm going to do it, but if you went in there and hunted one and shot it?
If you went in with the intention of hunting it and you shot it, I reckon the penalty would be quite severe.
Yeah, my dad was wondering. He was wondering if somebody took a bow and like a homeless person took a bow and arrow in there and killed one. Do you think they would be sent to prison? Is that sort of punishment? I think it probably is, isn't it? It's quite severe. It must be a very, very heavy fine.
Oh, I don't know, man. Maybe, probably not prison if you had a bow and arrow. Whereas if you've got a gun, I don't know, do you have the license? I think you're getting into dangerous territory.
True.
Yeah, so I don't really know how we like adjust from that to going into our conversation. But anyway, the idea for this week's episode is how worried are you? So what we're going to do is go through some of the Premier League's biggest sides. Talk about their starts to the season, and I'm going to ask you to give me a rating between 1 and 10 for how worried you are. So 1 means you're not worried at all. Maybe they've had some freak results, but everything's fine. 10 is like, I'm seriously concerned the wheels have come off. I think their season is basically over after 3 matches. So,
oh my God.
We're going to leave out Leicester and Liverpool for obvious reasons. We're going to leave out Arsenal as well, because though they were pretty bad against West Ham, they have won both their first 2 games at the time of recording. And so they're probably doing better than they deserve, to be honest. But the other traditional big sides are struggling right now. I mean, even in outside the Premier League, PSG are in 7th in Ligue 1. Bayern lost 4-1 to Hoffenheim yesterday, and they're 7th in Germany. Juve drew with Roma and had a red card on Sunday. They're down in 5th. So it's been quite a rough start to the season for traditional big sides, I think. And it's kind of their second, kind of another L, really, after in the summer the big teams were lobbying their respective leagues to continue the 5 substitute thing, which probably would have been an advantage for the richer sides, you'd have to imagine, who have bigger squads.
Yeah. Just on the 5 subs rule, by the way, have you seen that they're keeping that in the Champions League?
Oh my God.
That's being maintained in the Champions League.
I knew they were keeping it. Yeah, they're keeping it in the Europa as well, I think, which is kind of good given that we want to play our youth team in the Europa. So anyway, I think we should probably start off with the biggest story. We're recording this on a Monday. Yesterday was an extremely eventful day in the Premier League. So I'm going to start with Manchester City. And what I think I'm going to do, shall I count us out? Shall I go 1, 2, 3? And then we both say our number for how worried we are about Man City.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So remember, 1 is not worried at all. 10 is very seriously concerned. Okay. So after 3. 1, 2, 3, 5.
6.
Okay. That's more reasonable than I expected. 6. Okay. So why are you a 6 on Manchester City?
The reason I'm a 6 is I think they've got quite a few problem areas, and I see a lot of pundits and a lot of people at the moment chatting about the defence being a major issue in this side, and obviously it's a major issue in the side given that Laporte can't seem to string together a run of games without picking up an injury, can he? I'm not overly convinced about Eric Garcia's physicality in the Premier League, to be totally honest, especially alongside Nathan Ake. Benjamin Mendy looks a shadow of the player he was at Monaco. I feel like the Benjamin Mendy situation is a little bit like Luke Shaw. And I don't know whether he's ever going to fully recover and be the person they thought he was going to be.
Yeah.
But as bad as the defence is, I think there are issues all over the pitch. When I was watching them against Leicester, it's one of the few Pep Guardiola performances that I can think of where I was struggling to see how they're trying to play. I didn't really understand a lot of the patterns. The rhythm wasn't there. Not the biggest fan of the two defensive midfielders and leaving KDB at 10 and Sterling through the middle didn't really work. It feels like Aguero's going to struggle consistently throughout the season with injury. I wonder whether this is kind of going to be the final season. It tips over the tipping point of being like, maybe he's a little bit too injured now to be the starting striker in a team that challenges for titles every year. And Jesus is injured as well.
Yeah.
So I think there's probably three or four problem areas for Pep Guardiola. And I'm not sure that he's getting the right players in to fix it. I look at the departure of David Silva, and I think, is Ferran Torres going to have the impact there, given that Leroy Sané's also left? So you're looking at Ferran Torres being the replacement for Sané and David Silva. That's a bit risky for me, even if Phil Foden does come through and hit the heights he was supposed to. You know, they haven't replaced Vincent Kompany. It looks like they're finally going to do that with Ruben Dias. Haven't watched an awful lot of him, but from the Portuguese football fans that I've spoken to, aren't overly convinced that he's at that level to immediately step in and have a massive impact. And Nathan Ake feels like nothing more than a backup to Laporte. So I'm a little bit concerned for Man City. I don't think they've had a very good summer. And I think they needed to have a really good summer to claw in that gap with Liverpool.
Yeah, I mean, the Leicester game... The thing is, what makes me a little bit more positive is that obviously the first game of the season, away to Wolves, comfortably won. That's good. The squad's still really deep. We assume Pep can figure things out. The Leicester game as well, they were comfortably the worst side. You know, like they were horribly outplayed, and it was a Leicester side missing Pereira and Didi. They started Madison on the bench. They started a Marty and non-police Mendy and were still the better side. That is troubling. On the other hand, I looked at the XG and it was like 2.9 for Leicester to like 1.5 or something for City. But I do think that they're kind of a unique proposition there, Leicester. So 2.3 of that 2.9 XG they conceded was from three penalties, right? And I thought all the penalties, I don't think you can necessarily complain about them, but I did think they were all slightly soft.
Sloppy defend. They're all sloppy defending, though. They're all just lazy.
They are, but do you think that there's a player in the league who wins those two penalties as well as Jamie Vardy does?
Probably not, but then
he is amazing at winning penalties.
Then I look at the third penalty and I look at sort of Benjamin Mendy's positioning and allowing Madison to come on the inside of him like that. And I think, oh, you know, do I see Andy Robertson doing that? Probably not.
No.
And although I know you said that it was a comfortable win in the end against Wolves, but there were patches of that game where Wolves missed some absolute sitters. Jimenez and Podence in that game in particular could have had a hat trick. First half, it was all City. And then once I think Wolves worked out that they're playing the double pivot with Fernandinho and Rodri sat in front of the back line and Nuno tweaked it a little bit, I felt like City's back line suddenly looked massively vulnerable again. And I just, I think there's so much pressure on Dias to come in and be an immediate hit because the amount of money that Pep has now spent on defenders is absolutely monstrous at the club. I don't think is there a defender there that hasn't cost more than £40 million at the moment? I suppose maybe Otamendi, but he's leaving.
And Garcia, I suppose.
And Eric Garcia, who's also leaving. But it's kind of like, do I trust any of them? No. The Laporte's the only one of the seven defenders back there that I fully trust. And I think that's a massive worry for Pep Guardiola.
Well, yeah, I mean, I agree, but I do think Laporte is there to come back in. So that does make me feel immediately a bit more optimistic. Mm-hmm. But I agree. Like, I think this is a side that has spent so much money, that have so much money. Why is the squad still so patchy in these areas? Like, after the game, I saw people saying, you know, look, these are our backup centre-backs playing. But, like, you shouldn't go into a season with a guy who you might be about to sell to Barcelona and a guy who just got relegated with Bournemouth and saying, well, you know, like, we don't expect them to be good. You're the ones who said that they were going to get minutes. Like, if you don't think that Nathan Ake is good enough to play for you in the Premier League, you shouldn't have signed him. and they paid over £40 million for him. It's just absolutely insane. And they're playing 35-year-old Fernandinho in front of him in midfield. I just do not understand it at all, because like there are other clubs who've got way less money who are not in this position where if one player goes down, suddenly they've got absolutely nothing. Like, they're incredibly thin. It's just, it seems to me so insane that they've allowed it to get to that point. And it's more than one summer of letting it go that way, right? You know, like last year, they had basically two central midfielders, like Gundogan and Rodri.
Do you know what as well? Like, I just do want to caveat, though, that like, I presume it's the same for you. Your 5 rating out of 10 and my 6 is contextualized to Man City. It's like for them, it's not that obviously they're still one of the best teams in the league. They're probably going to finish in the top two, but I still think that the summer has been questionable and there's been some poor decision making at the top level. I think the Leroy Sané sale has just kind of slipped under the net. It's like €50 million did they get for him in the end, or €40 million? One of the most exciting young talents in the world, given that he was allowed to run his contract down. And I kind of look at that and think, bloody hell, who have they replaced him with? If Sterling's now going to have to play as a number 9, I don't really understand the thinking, and there's no joined up plan, which is very un-Manchester City-like in that forward area, I think.
Yeah, agreed. And I mean, I'd say though that yes, I agree that this is obviously like kind of calibrated to how good Man City are, but there's one thing which makes me a little bit, I probably would have been at a 4. If it weren't for this one other thing, which is that Adam Crafton, who writes for The Athletic, kind of retweeted like an article he wrote after the Champions League exit to Lyon, where club insiders revealed that the squad was kind of puzzled and a little bit annoyed by Pep's decision to drop the 4-3-3 they played pretty much all of last season, and to essentially customise themselves to match up against a team which had finished 7th. In Ligue 1. And at the time, his sources said there is some like discord in the dressing room, and if they're not careful, things could fall apart in dramatic fashion. Now, I don't think we're there yet, but I think that when you've got a team as accustomed to success as they are, and who have been told all along they have the best manager in the world, that they can have total faith in him, that they are never really going to lose because of like their manager not being good enough, only because of individual performances. If they do start losing because of managerial issues, maybe it does start to shake their confidence. That's the only thing.
Yeah, look, I still back them to finish in the top two. I really do. I think that they've got probably the best manager in the league alongside Jurgen Klopp, and they have probably got the second best squad. But that squad, I agree with you, is patchy, and I don't think the summer has been a positive. I think it's been a bit of a negative summer. I don't think that they even got their number one centre-back target in the end in Kalidou Koulibaly. There is still 7 days of the window left, so I don't want to just hammer them too hard, but it's a big 7 days, in my opinion, for Man City. I don't think Ruben Dias is enough.
Yeah, I completely agree. But we do have the window left. They do have money. Let's see what they do. Let's move on to the other side of Manchester, I think.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Ooh.
So Man United are a place behind Man City. They're in 14th currently, minus one goal difference, though they've also played two games, as have City, compared to three for most of the sides above them. So let me just think actually about what I'm going to rate. Okay. Right. Okay. I've got my rating out of 10, so I'll count us in and then let's give our ratings. Okay. So 1, 2, 3... Seven. Nice. Seven. Yeah. Okay. Do you want to go first?
Sure, I'll go first on Manchester United. Why not?
People want to hear from you, man.
Yeah, well, firstly, I think this is one that you really have to caveat with. That next 7 days are massive. And I do think that the next 7 days will probably define Manchester United's season as a whole. It can really make it or break it at this point. But I think Manchester United have had an absolutely horrific summer transfer window. One of the worst I can remember in recent times. And it's not just in terms of ins either. I actually think Donny van de Beek is a very good signing for Manchester United. What I don't think we've done well is sell. I can probably point to seven names on the Manchester United squad list that should no longer be at the club, or we've attempted to move on and have failed. You know, Chris Smalling, Phil Jones, Romero, Andreas Pereira, Jesse Lingard, Diogo Dalot's in there as well as a potential sale. And we've shifted none of them so far. It looks like Andreas Pereira might be about to leave the club with an option to buy to Lazio for about 20 million euros, which would be an interesting one for him. However, not only have we not sold well, we have not bought well. Donny van de Beek is an interesting player, and I think one that definitely adds depth to the midfield and a problem position for Manchester United, because Bruno was literally having to play every second of every game for Manchester United because the drop-off to Andreas Pereira or Jesse Lingard when they came in was so monumental. Where we haven't signed well is our four problem areas, and they have been four problem areas for a long time. Right wing. We never replaced Cristiano Ronaldo. And that was, what, 11 years ago? We still haven't got a right winger. As good as Mason Greenwood is, I feel like it's monumental pressure on an 18-year-old to score with every single shot at the moment. And he's obviously unbelievably talented, and I think he has an incredibly high ceiling, but it's too much pressure. So we need a right winger. We probably needed a left back, in my opinion. Brandon Williams, a right footer, naturally more of a right back. Leaves Luke Shaw there, who can't put together more than 30 starts in a season due to injury problems. We should have got a left-back through the door nice and early. Went with Reguilón. Obviously, that move collapsed because Real Madrid wanted the buyback option. Wasn't going to happen. Now seems we might get Alex Telles. I don't know too much about him, to be totally honest. I haven't watched an awful lot of Porto. It's, from what I've read, it seems quite promising. Central defence, another issue area for Manchester United, hasn't been addressed. Should have paid the buyout clause for Upper Meccano before he signed the new contract. Didn't happen. Defensive midfield, a huge problem area for Manchester United, because despite the fact Matic is... I actually think he's still fairly good on the ball. Off the ball, probably not good enough to play that role when you've got Pogba and Bruno in there. Mm-hmm. And when you combine all four of those things, it's a massive problem. The squad is so incredibly thin. It's almost shocking given how much we spent. So I have real big worries. I don't have so much worries in terms of our opening three or four performances. I actually really think that's a lot to do with rustiness within Manchester United. I really think that once we get to sort of October time and we're five or six games into the season, you'll see United starting to put together better patterns of play because, you know, Pogba's coming back. Pogba only got over coronavirus last week. Bruno didn't have a pre-season. We got him back the week before that. Wan-Bissaka only left quarantine last week. So I think when United actually start to get players together and refining a bit of form, then we'll be okay. But there is big issues with the transfer policy. There's big issues with the squad. And if the next 7 days aren't positive with at least two players coming through the door, I don't think United will finish in the top four, which is a massive worry.
I pretty much agree with everything you said, though I do think that these two performances are big enough problems that it's something to keep an eye on, I'll say.
Yeah, I would agree.
So United have 3 points. They should probably have none.
Yes.
They were inferior to Palace at home. They're inferior to Brighton away. Now, I think Brighton are probably better than we thought because they were also very good against Chelsea. We'll come on to that. I think Palace are actually probably better than we thought, given that I certainly thought of them as definite relegation candidates. On the other hand, I can't... the potential upside with Palace was they've got Eze coming in. They've brought in Batshuayi on loan. They're looking at Saeed Benrahma. Well, none of those guys were starting in this game, and yet they were kind of comfortably superior away at Old Trafford. And this is the thing. United's attack got a lot of credit in the back half of last season, and you and some other people pointed out, you know, like, look, it was starting to go a bit stale before the results dropped off. And obviously, yeah, reliant on Mason Greenwood, that's a bad position to be in, as talented as he is. He's 18. And really, he's probably a striker, not a right winger. And Bruno Fernandes can't score or assist in every single game he plays for the rest of his United career, because that's ridiculous. Not even De Bruyne does that. Their success last season was built on the fact that they had a solid defence. Like, people don't like to hear that, but I think they conceded, what, 3 goals more than Liverpool? Like, the defence was solid all season, and then conceded 14 shots to Palace, conceded 18 shots to Brighton. Now, it's entirely possible, you're right, that this is just early season rust and it will fall away. But I do think that if the defence is suddenly much, much worse than it was last year, the attack is going to have to be way, way better than it was last year to get them to the same position in the table. And that's what concerns me. Because then I think if you're not getting a Sancho type in, I find it hard to see where your edge is coming over the other teams competing for Champions League football.
Yeah, it's an interesting one because I think defensively, look, there's plenty of caveats around the Crystal Palace game, isn't there? You know, we're playing Timothy Fosu-Mensah at right back instead of Aaron Wan-Bissaka. It's a massive disparity in terms of defensive quality. You're not playing Nemanja Matic in there. You've got Scott McTominay sat in the hole, which, although we don't, at Football Daily, we don't think of Matic as a sort of superstar, he's probably a step up in that defensive midfield role over Scott McTominay. So there are little caveats to be had around there, but I totally agree. We're shipping too many shots, the defence looks shaky, and I would be surprised to see Victor Lindelof be the starting centre-back by the end of the season.
Interesting.
He's had 4 years now at Manchester United, and he has had positive moments and positive runs of sort of 10 weeks, maybe 8 weeks. But overall, when you look at his contribution in its entirety, I think it hasn't quite worked out. And I'm not too sure it works alongside Maguire because neither of them are athletic enough to cover for the other's deficiency. Mm-hmm. I think if you've got Harry Maguire in there, who, yeah, he gets hammered, but if we're being honest with ourselves, he is very good on the ball. He's extremely consistent, played every minute of every game last season for Manchester United in that defence that conceded just 36 goals. And is a leader. He's the captain of the club. So you're not going to disperse it. He's not going to be moved out of that club. Or that starting spot. Lindelof, if he could be transferred out, and this is what's so frustrating about Eric Bailly, really, because Eric Bailly has the attributes to be that other starting centre-back. He's athletic. You know, he's much, much quicker than Harry Maguire. Fairly good on the ball. Really good in the air. Probably better than Harry Maguire in the air. That's something Victor Lindelof struggles with massively at Manchester United. But he can't put together more than 10 games without getting a serious injury. Mm. And you've got to start to think to yourself, if he can't do it, Lindelof can't do it, do we trust Axel Tuanzebe to do it? I'm afraid Axel Tuanzebe looks like he might have similar sort of problems to Eric Bailly in the injury department. Very, very injury prone. So United might want to dip into the market. It's not going to be this summer, I don't think. United are going to dip into the market for a centre-back this summer. We've got 8 centre-backs on the books. They have to be sold before United sign central defensive talent. And I think what you'll see is United not go for a centre-back this summer and go balls to the wall for Upamecano next summer. I think the club realised they made a bit of a mistake missing out on the buyout clause earlier in the summer. There's plenty of very reliable reporters in the Telegraph, I think James Ducker talking about it, that he is one of the top players on Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's wish list, and it's not going to happen this summer. So I think that's unrealistic. Sadly, I think a defensive midfielder is probably unrealistic at this stage. This morning, there's links with N'Golo Kante. I don't see that happening. It doesn't really fit as part of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer or the club's new vision in terms of transfers. So I think you'll see a left-back and a right-winger come in the next 7 days. And whoever those players are could end up defining the season. Because there's going to be a lot of pressure on Alex Telles going forward, especially because it's one of United's weakest areas. The lack of attacking endeavour from our fullbacks is a massive problem because the opposition know it's happening. Know that Wan-Bissaka can't cross the halfway line, and Luke Shaw can't cross it either. So just funnel us centrally. And then all they have to do is stick 4 men on Bruno and we're in massive trouble. So I think we need some attacking endeavour from the fullback area. And if Telles is the guy to do that, then fair enough. And we need Jadon Sancho on the right wing. If United get Jadon Sancho, Pato, do you think that could really propel and change the sort of season structure for them?
Oh yeah, definitely. Like, I mean, if you got Jadon Sancho, obviously it depends what's going on with the defence. Yeah. Because you can have an elite attacker and if your defence is terrible, you're going nowhere. Like, we saw this with Spurs last season, we saw this with Arsenal, like, because the defence was so bad. So it really is going to require them to get that defence together. But Sancho is the sort of elite player who means that United would just remain relevant for the next 10 years regardless of what else is going on, because he's that good. But you then have an extremely young and very talented front line. You know, like Rashford is now, I think, one of the best all-round left wingers in the league. Martial is not... I would like him to look more like a striker than he does. I'd like him to get some more shots, but his link-up play is very good. He can obviously exchange with Rashford as well. Greenwood, every time I watch him, and to be honest, like, I think this is borne out by the stats as well. Like, he just is a striker to me. Like, he's not that much of a dribbler. He's not a creator. But he's not going to lose the ball a lot because he's not going to do stupid, over-ambitious stuff. And he's a great finisher. He's really two-footed. If you add Sancho to that as well, then that front line is going to be able to compete with the best in the world for years to come. It just remains to be seen what you do around the rest of the squad.
Yeah, big 7 days for Manchester United. But I do believe that United are going to do a madness. There's something in me that feels like there's big money to be spent at Manchester United and they're holding their cards rather close to the chest.
But the only possible madness is Sancho, right?
Yeah, but it wouldn't surprise me that United get Sancho, Telles and another. But I'm not sure who that other would be. I'm a bit surprised Telles is taking as long as it is. It feels like that haggle is a bit pointless over £2 or 3 million with Porto. But nevertheless, I'm trying to give them a bit of time, Man United, because you know everybody's battering the board, aren't they? And rightly so to a level. But the window's still open. And if United end the summer with Jadon Sancho, Donny van de Beek, Alex Telles, and maybe one more, people suddenly go, actually, that was a pretty decent summer.
Yeah, fair point. Well, shall we move on then to another team who have actually had plenty of credit for their summer, but currently are not playing like a side that we kind of expected to compete for potentially the top two? It's Chelsea. They're on 4 points after 3 games. Now, in there, they've got a deserved loss to Liverpool where they went down to 10 men. Not much you can do about that. But a pretty embarrassing draw with West Brom and a very lucky win over Brighton as well. I thought they were the inferior team against Brighton, got outshot. Their goals, you know, like it took an absolute wonder strike from James, a penalty that deflected one from Zouma to give them the win against Liverpool. I thought that defensively they were all right in the first half, but they really did just sell out to get a 0-0. Like they were creating nothing in attack and then a silly red card just got them ripped apart. And again, West Brom, yes, if you look at the stats, they actually look like they were pretty good. Like 2.4 XG to 0.9, 22 shots to 9. But that's because they went a goal down. They were behind from the third minute until the 92nd minute of that game. And the defending was horrific. I mean, I think clearly this is a case of expected goals, like getting it wrong, right? Because when you look at the second and third goals for West Brom in particular, they're just absolutely shambolic. So I'll count us in and then we'll say how worried we are about Chelsea. Scale of 1 to 10. Okay, yeah. So 1, 2, 3, 4.
2.
Ooh, 2.
2.
Okay, I'm a bit more worried than you then, I'm going to say. A little bit more. Okay, tell me why you're a 2. I assume we've got similar reasons for not being like 6.
Yeah, I'm really not that worried about Chelsea. If I was a Chelsea fan, I'd be very, very comfortable so far, to be totally honest with you. I think they've got to be realistic about their expectations, and I don't think a title challenge is realistic this summer,
sure,
given that they've got to have time to bed these players. But I think overall, there's very little to be worried about. I think Frank Lampard is still trying to figure out what his team is and where players are going to play, particularly the likes of Kai Havertz. But, you know, still got Ben Chilwell to come in. Thiago Silva will have an impact at the club. I don't think it'll be as big as some people think, and I don't think it'll be as bad as some people think, particularly the likes of George in the WhatsApp group. But I think he'll be fine, and he can be made memes out of, and there'll be plenty done after that West Brom game. But I do think he improves the backline when he plays alongside Kurt Zouma, which I think will probably end up being their starting centre-back pairing with Ben Chilwell on the left, Reece James on the right. If they get the new goalkeeper performing well, that's another positive. I don't know whether he's quite worked out what his midfield 3/2 is going to be yet. I still think the best option is probably Kovacic and Kante to be sat as a double pivot with Havertz in front of them. Pulisic, who's yet to play and is unfit on the left. Ziyech, who's yet to play and is unfit on the right. And then Werner through the middle, who looks razor sharp already, I think. Looks really, really positive. And Tammy having an impact off the bench. So I don't think we've seen the best Chelsea team yet. And overall, I'm just not too worried because I don't think Frank has found where he wants people to play. He's tried Havertz on the left, he's tried him on the right, he's tried him in midfield, he's tried him as a false nine. You know, it's going to take a bit of time to find Kai Havertz's balance within this team. And I think there's other positives that have gone under the radar. The likes of Mason Mount continues to be a very solid player in this Chelsea team and rotating really nicely. Tammy Abraham has started scoring goals again. So I'm not worried at all about Chelsea. I think they're going to be absolutely fine and finish comfortably third, which is exactly what I was expecting them to do before.
Okay. I agree with like 90% of that. But I do think that they've been really bad in these first few games. And even if they just rolled out the team from last season, they were way better than this. Yes, I think Chilwell obviously helps the defence. We assume Thiago Silva settles, though of course he made an error for a goal in that West Brom game, which is a bit of a worry. You can see, you know, Pulisic and Ziyech obviously going to help the attack. But in those first three games, he's tried three different formations. And while I understand you saying, yes, he needs to figure out what he wants to do with Havertz, I think he should have figured that out before signing him.
I think that's largely to do with the fact he hasn't got his starting wide man. I think Pulisic is the best player in the team and immediately takes them from a 6 out of 10 to an 8 out of 10 on the left. And I think Ziyech starts on the right. I don't think he's had those options. That's why he's not been able to play Havertz in the 10 role.
Okay, I'd like to believe that. But last season, he didn't really make Pulisic a regular starter until he absolutely had to. There were plenty of times where he was dropping him, even when Pulisic had been clearly his best wide player. It seems like he's going to try and play Mason Mount whenever he can. Like, I do genuinely think that, like, Frank Lampard's ideal starting 11 might include Mason Mount. Like, I worry that that's the situation. And it's not a worry as in, like, Mason Mount's bad, but it's a worry in that I'm not sure that Lampard knows how best to set up this side and who his best players are. That concerns me a little bit. Chilwell obviously improves things. Mendy probably improves things, though at the moment, goalkeeping hasn't really been an issue through the first couple of games of the season. Like,
not the Liverpool one. Oh, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know whether I believe that, actually, because the Liverpool one's a whiffer.
And the also, Brighton one.
I think the Brighton one's a bit of a whiffer.
Yeah, but they also didn't concede other big chances that you'd expected them to concede. So I think they're coming out about even. Like, I'm not saying that there aren't shots. There were shots that should have been saved that weren't saved, but there were shots that should have gone in that didn't go in. So, okay. Like, overall, over these few games, I think they're about even. I mean, yeah, started like a sort of 4-2-2-2 the first game of the season. Then there was the 4-3-3 against Liverpool with Havertz as a nine. Then that 4-2-3-1 against West Brom, which I think is probably much closer to the right setup. But because they drew that, I wouldn't be surprised if then Frank Lampard goes into the next game and changes it again. And my concern is just that, like, he's just going to overthink it. And he did this last season, actually. They were on a run where their performances were really good. When you watch them, they were really dominant. Their stats were really good. But they weren't getting the results. And Frank Lampard went and completely changed the formation. And I thought, oh, my worry is that you aren't actually very good at telling whether something's working or not. That's my concern. However, I agree with you that I think there's literally too much talent in this side for anything to go that wrong.
Yeah, I totally agree. I really agree. I think that Frank Lampard could take 10 games to find the right balance, which might well end up happening. And you might see Chelsea sort of 8th in the league after 10 games or 6th in the league after 10 games, not really putting it together. And then suddenly the talent just shines through. Pulisic finds a run of form. Werner finds a run of form. Havertz finds a run of form. Tammy finds a run. One of the 5 or 6 star players they've got in this side, yeah, just have to find a run and they'll be absolutely fine.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, they're the one of all these teams we're talking about, they're the one I'm least concerned about. Yeah. I'm not necessarily saying they're going to finish above Man City, but I'm least concerned about how their season's going to go relative to expectations.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Should we move on to the final team we're going to cover today? Tottenham. Yes. Hotspur.
Okay.
Tottenham, I think, I think they're top of these four sides right now, right? They're in seventh. They're on 4 points. They obviously had that home loss to Everton to start the season, away win at Saints, which was a ridiculous game, home draw with Newcastle in also ridiculous circumstances. I'll count us in, and you can say how worried you are. Let me just have a think where I am on this. Okay. 1, 2, 3, 4. 6. Ooh, 6. Okay, excellent. Right, I'm really excited. Tell me why you're a 6.
I'm a 6 majoritarily because Jose Mourinho is managing the club. Is the reason that I'm
yeah,
a little
that, that's
bit
kind
worried
of my issue as well
about Tottenham Hotspur. But overall, I think they've had a better summer than Manchester United to start with, which is why they're not a 7. I think they've had a similar sort of summer level-wise with Manchester City. I don't believe they've upgraded in the areas they needed to upgrade, which is a bit of a problem. I think they definitely needed a centre-back upgrade on Eric Dier or Davinson Sanchez, somebody who was going to start there week in, week out, because it seems like that's going to be Jose's go-to centre-back partnership. Alderweireld's not going to play. I think Reguilón is an upgrade on Ben Davis, but I have big concerns about it. I think that Matt Doherty is an upgrade on Aurier, but I have big concerns about it. So I think overall, I'm sort of middle ground on their summer. I don't think they've got the best squad, and I don't think they've got a particularly fantastic manager. I think if Harry Kane gets injured again, they're in massive trouble still. I don't think anything's changed there. Son's already pulled his hamstring, game week 3, which concerns me in the long run. And if Harry Kane picks up an injury, where are the goals coming from? Again, okay, Bale might hit the ground and be an absolute blockbuster and might prove me totally wrong. But I think he's a 10 to 15 goal involvement player now, really, for Tottenham Hotspur, given the amount of game time he's going to play. If he does more than 10 to 15 goal involvements, I'd be pretty shocked. So where is the 20 goals coming from if Harry Kane gets injured? That's a massive deficiency, and Harry Kane is likely to get injured. I think Dele Alli's being left out of the squad is a bit of a puzzling one. That feels like a classic Jose Mourinho sort of club move, quite political. I don't get it, because I think he is still an outstanding attacking option for them. And Ndombele still kind of seen, it looks like he's still seen in the same regard as Lo Celso. It doesn't feel like Jose thinks they can play together. It's either one or the other, replacing each other. But Winks still plays every game. So, I don't know. I'm not overly convinced about it. I think the left-back, right-back balance is weird as well. Watching the documentary, Jose made a whole kerfuffle about wanting to have Aurier really high up the pitch in this sort of almost right-wing hybrid right-back role, allowing Ben Davis to shuffle centrally and play as one of a back three in transition, and then when the defending slot back into a back four, which is, works with Matt Doherty because he plays very advanced, doesn't he? You're going to see him get in the box. You're going to see him get on the end of 1-2s. But do I then see Reguilón as the left back who's going to slot into a back three in transition and play as a centre back? Is that what Reguilón's being bought for? If it is, I don't think it's the right player. And if it's not, does that mean he's going to play attacking football? Because if he plays high up the pitch along with Matt Doherty, I think that Winks protecting Dier and Sanchez is a recipe for disaster. So I'm not convinced. I'm not convinced at all by the summer. I think they still need a striker and they still need a centre-back. If they get them, then it could all change.
Okay, so here's why I'm slightly less concerned than you. I do think Bale could feasibly fill in at centre-forward. I think that's possible. On the other hand, if Ali is being left out of the team, then I do worry a little bit more, because you're losing some goals there, you're losing some creativity there. So even if you add a bit with Bale, are you adding enough to make up for that? I'm not sure. I completely agree about Winks being a regular starter. I think I like Højbjerg as a signing. He's my third favourite of their central midfielders.
So what midfield would you play?
Ndombele, Lo Celso.
Just as a double pivot?
Yeah, but it's obviously never, ever going to happen. I mean, like, this is the thing. Like, he's starting what I think of as their third and fourth best central midfielders.
I don't think they can start together as a double pivot. I really think they've got to have a defensively minded player in there. Because I think
who
Lo Celso
is
best.
They don't have one at the moment.
But I think if you were... Lo Celso is best when he's carrying the ball past players, as is Ndombele.
Yeah.
But if they both progressively run up the field, I think this is, at least if you put Højbjerg in there, he's just going to do the grubby shit.
Yeah, I'm fine with that. That's not my issue. I'm happy for Højbjerg to be starting in a three-man midfield. But in a two-man midfield, my first two choices would not be Winks and Højbjerg to play together. So that's a little bit of an issue I have. And I hadn't actually thought about the Reguilón factor, but that's definitely true. Yeah, they've got two really attacking fullbacks, which is very un-José Mourinho.
Yeah.
On the other hand, Kane has started the season very well.
Yes.
He ended last season quite well. If Kane is back to his best, whatever that looks like, if Kane is better than he's been the last couple of years, that is going to help them an awful lot. On the other hand, he got four assists in that game against Southampton, and that was mostly, I think... That was in a game, to be honest, where Spurs shouldn't have been still in the match, by the second half. They were so outplayed in the first half, they shouldn't have had a shot. And then in the second half, it was just kind of every long ball Harry Kane played just gave Son a one-on-one. It was absolutely ridiculous. The Newcastle game, they definitely should have won. Got a bit unlucky there, ridiculous penalty.
That was one of the better Jose Mourinho performances at Tottenham, I think.
I think so as well. Yeah, I think that's probably when they beat Arsenal, that was also a good performance. But anyway, if Kane's currently taking four shots a game, yes, it's only three matches, but that's pretty decent. My concern is about Mourinho that firstly, he's going to select the wrong players from the squad he has. Secondly, he's going to alienate good players like Dele Alli, like Tongi and Ndombele. Thirdly, I think that he's just too conservative in big games. In the Everton match, I mean, that's not a huge game or whatever, but Everton are rivals with Spurs for European football. And Spurs didn't really lay a glove on them at home. Everton were comfortably dominant in that game, I thought. And, Spurs' best chance was when Kane set up Doherty for a shot. And it just, I don't know, it all looks really uninspired. And yes, again, Kane, Bale, Son, Lo Celso, Ndombele, Alli, it's possible these guys come back into the side and everyone clicks and everything's great. But it's also possible that Jose Mourinho just explodes, really in his first full season, and they just get massacred a couple of times and Jose's out.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really interesting to see the team when he has everyone fit. Because my head, you'd be lining up, Lloris, probably Reguilón and Doherty, despite the fact I don't think they work for Jose as fullbacks and they're too attacking. Without Skriniar arriving, it's going to be Dier and it's going to be Sanchez, despite the fact Alderweireld's there. Then I think he should just play Højbjerg and Ndombele alongside each other. Ndombele being slightly more progressive, with Lo Celso in the 10 role, Son on the left, Bale on the right, and Kane through the middle. But I just don't think you're ever going to see that 11. I think it's really unlikely, especially given that Jose has this real fixation on Harry Winks, rightly or wrongly, and in my opinion, wrongly, playing him every single week. So it's going to be tough. But what I've seen from Spurs so far, a little bit like Manchester United, has been poor. Really poor. Scraped past Plovdiv. Played off the park by Everton. Yeah, okay, it was a good performance from Newcastle, but overall it's been extremely mediocre. And how many of the players he signed really take them up to the next level? Maybe Reguilón. Not too sure Højbjerg does, not too sure Doherty does. I think they're more sort of that warrior spirit and real battler that Jose's trying to instill in the dressing room. I don't know. I'm a bit unconvinced. I think Tottenham, alongside Manchester United, are in a real battle for that fourth place. I don't think either of them have taken the step forward to push beyond that.
Yeah, it's actually really, really enjoyable being so negative about all the other teams in the Premier League right now. But it does genuinely feel like maybe it's because as well, away games aren't quite as difficult as they were, or... Yeah, because of rust and injuries and stuff, but it does kind of feel like the league is a lot less predictable at the moment. So should we move on then to one thing we learned for this week?
Yeah.
Because on the topic of the league's unpredictability, I know that you have a particular bugbear here.
Well, we have to talk about the penalty situation, don't we? It's an absolute fiasco right now. 21 penalties in 25 games. On current course, I think it's over 300 penalties across the league season, which would be absolutely unheard of. It's ridiculous. And it's been really highlighted this weekend, hasn't it? But this has not been just a one weekend issue. Man United had an absolute shocker against Palace as well, where the ball bounced up and hit Lindelof. The Leeds game first week, absolutely disastrous. The three this weekend, I think two of them were the wrong decision. I do think people will say bias, but I do think the Mopay one, his hand is in a ridiculous position. It is effectively blocking the ball above his head. I think that is a penalty. But Joel Ward's is an absolute disaster. Digne's 3 yards away, heading the ball down, and his hand's an inch away from his knee. It doesn't affect it at all. And not only that, Eric Dier has his back to goal and it hits the back of his arm. It's pathetic. I don't understand how this rule has been interpreted so horrifically badly. Whether it's the Premier League, whether it's IFAB, I'm not too sure. But it has to change because we cannot go for a full season of anything hitting the arm below the shoulder from a goal-bound shot or in any situation within the box to penalty, because we're going to have penalties coming out of our arse. I think VAR has really taken a step forward this season by going, please go to the monitor and review your own decision. Massive step forward, immediately changes people's perception of VAR, and then suddenly they shoot themselves in the foot with a ridiculous interpretation of the handball rule, being that it hits you below the shoulder, it's a handball, whatever the situation is. It's so backwards that I'm getting frustrated by it, and we're in week three. I think by week six, we could have serious revolt on our hands amongst Premier League coaches. You know it's bad when opposition managers... I saw Steve Bruce do 5 press conferences yesterday, and in all 5, he said it's absolutely ridiculous. And he was the one benefiting from it. So I just cannot believe how badly interpreted this rule has been, and the Premier League have got to address it.
Yeah, it's this like intersection of like the different handball rule and VAR that just like is a perfect storm. But yeah. I was also thinking, was it United's game against Palace where the penalty was retaken?
Yeah, where he's an inch off the line.
That I watched that. I just laughed when that happened. I genuinely, I could not believe that that was made to be retaken. I was like, what's he meant to do?
I know, it's absolutely ridiculous. And it wasn't a handball in the first place. And then you get that. They've got to be careful that they don't become sort of picky with incidents on VAR. It can't be used for that. It has to be used to clarify and then overturn. It can't be used to, oh, is he an inch off his goal line? Oh, grow up. Come on, it doesn't make a difference. He would have saved it anyway. But I just think this penalty ruling is just, it's an abomination. It's an absolute abomination.
Yeah, I completely agree. Like, I think it's all over the place, and I just think they need to change the rule, or they might even need to get VAR out of that somehow. Like, it's just...
They've got to change the rule. It has to be a change of the rule. It has to go back to the original one.
Okay. I mean, I think that probably would work, but I still think with VAR, we're going to get in trouble in this situation just because stuff's always going to get called back. And like, then if something's given on the field, then like for it to be overturned, the burden is still like the standard is still quite high. I don't know. I'm troubled about it. And you just know every team, to be honest, like every team gets some point in the season with penalties. Normally not every team, but a lot of teams do. This season I think every team will.
United could get 100 penalty kicks though, which would absolutely delight me, because there's nothing better than United scoring a penalty just to watch football Twitter's piss boil. It's fantastic.
But I mean, I feel like half your goals are scored from penalties now.
They are, and it's absolutely gorgeous. It's so much fun watching United get penalty after penalty, and Bruno never misses a penalty either. That's what's so glorious about it. He's got to be the best penalty taker I've seen at your club since like Cantona. It just, every time he stands over the ball, it goes top corner. And it's so good to wind all these idiots up on Twitter. I just love it. Inject it into my veins. United getting penalties after the full-time whistle's gone. I love it.
Oh, this is, yeah, I mean, that did make it kind of amazing. But this is like pure couchiopoly in effect now, I feel. But I don't know. I'm not sure I'm going to do a thing I learned, because I just think that is like too compelling. Though I guess we did learn that Bayern Munich are mortal this weekend, because they lost 4-1 to Hoffenheim. And I saw about 10-15 minutes of it, and they were getting ripped apart by Hoffenheim. Kramaric had 8 shots. Lewandowski had 1. It was crazy. Like, genuinely, it was crazy. Skov could have scored another one. Like, it was all over the shop. I genuinely couldn't believe what I was seeing.
Yeah, I was watching Euro Roundup, which Doogie produced by himself this week, and he was talking about Kramaric, actually, and he made a really interesting point, I thought. Do you think that Kramaric is potentially the most underrated forward in Europe? It was Doogie's point.
Yeah, probably.
You know, everywhere he's been, effectively, other than obviously Leicester, he scores 15 to 25 goals a season. Guaranteed, nailed on. And we were talking about Ilicic being one of the most underrated. Then he kind of hit the headlines. But Kramaric never gets any respect.
No.
Ever.
No.
And I think he's got 5 goals in 2 games this season.
And this is, and I mean, like, under Nagelsmann, you could understand it a bit because it was like, look, everyone scores loads of goals under Nagelsmann. Like, Belfodil scored loads of goals under Nagelsmann. Yeah. But now Nagelsmann's gone, he's still doing it. So maybe he is just actually an amazing player.
Yeah, I mean, Leicester wouldn't mind having him as a backup to Vardy now, would they? But equally, it just didn't work out, so can't begrudge it.
Yeah, I think it's totally fine. But that's pretty much our show for the week. Joe, is there anything that you'd like to point to before we say goodbye?
Go and watch the reaction that will have gone out to Liverpool versus Arsenal. I'm putting that out, I think, Tuesday morning, if not Monday night. Hopefully, if it's a good game. If it's not, you'll never see the light of day.
Yikes. I mean, I don't think it's going to be fun. I would consider not watching that. But thanks very much for joining me. And thank you to you guys at home for watching this or listening to this. If you're not subscribed to Football Daily Podcast, make sure that you do. Drop us a like if you enjoy the podcast. And of course, find it on your favorite podcast app, Overcast, Stitcher, iTunes, Spotify, whatever you want to use. I have to think of all the podcast app names every week, and every week I don't remember them. But we thank you very much for your support, and we'll see you next time. Bye.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.